Just want to say hi to everyone and hope that you've had a good week. What are the way our schedule is going to be tonight? It's real similar to what Lyndall and Lauren did last week. We're going to have just a short sit and then check in, and people get a chance to talk about how their week was practicing with the third tetrad. Then Steve's going to give a talk, and then I'll do a guided meditation, and then we'll have more time for discussion and Q&A and thoughts. And then we will close with announcements and dedication of merit at 8:30. So that's our schedule. So I think it's really nice to start. I was inspired by Lauren and Lyndall doing this before, where we have just a short sit to have us all arrive, know that we've set the intention to come and practice together this evening, and we'll just sit for about 5 minutes. But I invite you all to find a good posture of relaxed and upright. Perhaps reminding yourself of your intention, why you wanted to participate in this series on the Anapanasati Sutta. I know that for me, I feel a sense of gladness that I'm here, that I signed up to share this series with all you lovely people. And I'd like to invite everyone for this sit to just make a quick note to yourself of what the state of your mind, the state of your body is like as we start this evening. What the body feels like. Is it pretty relaxed, or are you feeling kind of a tension and little uptightness? Or you might notice if there is some tension, whereabouts that is showing up. And making a note of what the mind is like as we start. Is it pretty quiet? Is it restless? Do you find that you're rehashing the day, or maybe a couple days? And just using words similar to the body feels like this, the mind feels like this, just make a note and keep it in the background. Later, when we actually have a longer sit, we're going to revisit where the mind and body has been. Now we have some time to just have folks check in how the week's been with your practice, not just the last week, perhaps all of the first 3 weeks of this series. And if there are any questions, I invite Lyndall and Lauren and Steve to all participate in responding. And anyone want to be brave and get us started? How this is being? Shashi, thank you. Get us started.
I found the exercises, as you know, the training exercises, as the weeks went by, they, you know, were more difficult from the standpoint that, you know, the first week was paying attention to the body. The second week was paying attention to mental formations, which is somewhat easy to get your arms around. But then when you start thinking about the mind, it's, you know, more sort of amorphous, intangible, harder to get my arms around. So if we could talk a little bit about that, that would be great. But what I did find is that going through these exercises, the time of my meditation went by real quickly. I mean, before I knew it, it was, you know, I felt like I had to sort of rush through the latter parts of it, but that was good. So, thank you.
Sure, thank you. You know, perhaps Lyndall or Lauren would like to respond to making any comment about as we're practicing with the mind.
I guess I could start to say something. I feel like in a way the mind may not be so very, very different from mental formations, although it could include more things. But as I understand it, it's really sort of noticing what's the attitude of mind, you know. Is there craving in the mind? Does the mind, or does it feel pretty contented? Is it scattered or more concentrated? Is it restless or calm? Is thinking happening? Are certain emotions happening? But there's a lot to know, and I found this really challenging too, because I would feel like I'd kind of got through the first eight, and then I'd start getting to that number nine, and then I wouldn't have enough time to do the rest of that third series.
Uh-huh.
It's a lot.
It's a lot. Did you also, either Shashi or Lyndall or anyone else, find that once you were getting into the mind, you also got grabbed by the content of what was coming up?
Oh, yeah.
Shashi, you too?
Yes, I did too. Yeah. And so I focused a little bit more on what Lyndall just said, is focusing on the thoughts arising in the mind.
Mm-hmm.
Trying to watch that.
Yeah. Steve Armstrong used to use the phrase the flavor of the mind, which I like that of what, yeah. Go on, Lauren, I'm sorry.
There's one thing that a teacher of Anapanasati was suggesting in his guided meditation was what is the mind, just to kind of question what is our focus when we say the mind, in addition to the content, like the formations. And he said, space, consider the space of the mind. And when I when I do that, it kind of shifts. It's just an interesting contemplation to think of the space of the mind, because then you start getting into formlessness. You know, it's like it's a different space. So I know a part of it is the attitude and the content, you know, the actual formations, but I just wanted to throw that in because I found that very interesting.
Thank you.
And of course, the mind is also this container that has plenty of craziness and goofiness and wisdom and discernment and clear seeing. So it's quite the container.
Yes.
Yeah, for a way of understanding experience.
Yeah, thank you. I like that idea of the container too. And Steve, what is the quote you have on your emails about the mind?
Mind is luminous, obscured by visiting defilements.
Yeah.
The miracle discourses.
Anyone else? How's this being? I know that for me, I've been feeling a greater intimacy with the breath. Just, I barely have to think of any of the instructions. I just, I feel so connected to the in and out breath. And look and curious as to what's happening when that's going on. And I've appreciated that sense of intimacy with it in a different way than what I've experienced before. Yes, Joyce, please.
So the last phrase is liberating the mind, at least in one of these translations that you sent. And so I was getting confused with, well, liberating the mind first after I gladdened it and then steadied it and then liberated. The only thing I was thinking of is that I was just emptying it, basically, and being aware of awareness. But I was having trouble doing that while I was focusing on breathing in and breathing out. So I don't know if you have any other ideas of what could be meant by that last phrase.
My understanding of it is that a big part of it is the liberating the mind of the hindrances. So you had this sense that right now, you know, the mind isn't really being troubled by craving. It's not really being troubled by aversion and restlessness and these other kinds of things. It's pretty calm and peaceful. So that's what I think about for that, because the liberating is such a huge word. And in a sense, you know, liberating in the sense of just resting in awareness. If the mind is resting in awareness, it isn't troubled by the hindrances. So that could be, you know, your experience of it. And as far as doing the breathing in and out and doing all these other things, I felt like that's kind of a, for me, sort of an experiment of how to do it. It's sort of stay with the breath a little bit and then go back to looking at whatever I'm looking at and then breathe in and out a little bit and then go back. There's certain things that you can feel like you can breathe in and out with that thing, but but other things not so easy. Mm-hmm. So yeah, I think it's a little bit of a learning process as well. For me too.
I've also heard it translated as releasing mind. And I think of it also as, you know, releasing the ways we identify mind as me and constrict it. So we're releasing and letting it flow, because everything by experiencing and then gladdening and then steadying is sort of a less and less concretization there. So releasing, and it kind of walks into the fourth tetrad also.
And then tonight, hopefully, Joyce, we're not going to make it even more confusing, because this is actually where there is pointing towards the relinquishment and the cessation of clinging, and which then leads to freedom. So like Lyndall said, liberating and freedom are big words. And sometimes those big things happen in little teeny ways. So we'll see how this goes tonight. And then, as we all know, we are skipping one Thursday. So back when we come back on the 25th, we'll see whether we've got some clarity or whether it's still, we'll see what happens. Yeah. Anybody else? We've got another minute or so. And, okay. Yes, Dan.
I realize what I have wanted from this is I definitely have a need for more stability. The other things I want to accomplish, like I was saying this morning, for what it's worth, is taking a class on the Four Noble Truths. I feel like the ideas are making sense to me, but I don't have the stability yet to really stay with them. So I was hoping that this practice would be something I could say, okay, this is going to be my go-to practice for the next period of time. But I have to admit, it is a little confusing.
By stability, do you mean like a steadiness of mind as in, you know, concentration, or do you mean stability of sort of your attitude or settledness on the direction of the path?
No, Steve, stability, steadiness of mind.
Okay.
I feel like so much of, like, as I'm saying, there are concepts, the Four Noble Truths, there are other things that just make perfect sense to me. But I feel like it, you know, I keep relating this to like going to the gym or something, that I need to develop more of the strength and capacity that I can then use to do the things I want to do, which is go hiking and biking and playing things.
Well, let's see where, since I'm, you know, offering this fourth one, let's see where that goes. But, you know, one thought would be that you could say that the way to understand whether a path is working is to see how we are, kind of what our relationship with life is. And that may be separate from whether or not we have some kind of shamatha or, you know, samadhi, absorption, which I personally am not very good at. But nonetheless, the path really changes us. And there's a way in which when we're becoming more mindful, we're seeing more clearly the underlying movement of the mind, which can look like instability, but actually we're just seeing clearly that our mind is kind of a mess or kind of a very busy place. So it's, you know, we're seeing clearly and we're just seeing, it's like standing at a street corner. You know, you can't make the traffic stop sometimes, but you can see it.
Well, just to add, and maybe this is the wrong way to look at it. I feel like I want the stability in order to accomplish something else for which a more stable mind seems to be required, which are like the Four Noble Truths I'll go back to, which just seem to me so such a powerful guide to the misery of my current life. But it takes a lot of I'll keep saying stability, whatever, focus, concentration, to kind of penetrate, hold those ideas in place long enough to be able to use them when I'm getting swept away by other things.
I mean, yes, it's a wonderful tool to hone, and no, it's not a problem if it's not arising right now. It's kind of the way I hold it anyway.
Yeah, no kidding. And intention is so important with that too, that the intention to open oneself to the truth of the Four Noble Truths and to see them, see those elements as they arise in your daily life, and have the intention to keep paying attention and to be curious and be interested. And sometimes I think, at least for me, I can be curious and interested in a with a less than steady mind. It sometimes is a little bit distracted, but I come back to it because I have such a strong intention to practice. And I keep bringing it into my daily life. So I don't know if that helps at all, Dan, but that's kind of my experience with how do I stay with things that are important, like what you mentioned.
Yeah.
Well, let's see. Let's give Steve the floor or the
window for something.
Something, and see what happens. I'm going to just ask everybody to mute, and so we won't have side noise while Steve is doing his thing.
Airplanes and things. Yeah. So. Yeah, it's wonderful to be here and greatly honoring my colleagues who have gone before me, humbled, in fact. But I want to share this fourth tetrad of the Anapanasati Sutta, and therefore the last four steps, which starts with impermanence and focuses into where that takes us. I want to offer a little context and just back up a little bit just to kind of give a little bit of an overview and then talk about the last one. So this Anapanasati Sutta, it's a 16-step practice, takes us from identification of body to full awakening or liberation from a Buddhist point of view. And the translation, mindfulness of breathing, is because anapana means inhalation and exhalation in Pali, and sati refers to mindfulness. So it's, as you know from what we've been saying, it's the practice the Buddha himself used when he went on retreat, which is always amazing. He was an awakened being, and he would go on retreat for a month. And this is a practice he said he used. And what's really interesting is the sutta approaches the matter of awakening or the process of practice a little differently than the four foundations of the Satipatthana Sutta, even though it's closely aligned with them because the four tetrads parallel the four foundations. In essence, the Satipatthana Sutta is about what to be mindful of and how, with a parallel teaching of what this mindfulness brings us. And as most of you know, that sutta refers to the four foundations of mindfulness: body, vedanas, mind, and dhammas, or mind objects. And then there's this refrain repeated 13 times, which states the result of all these manifestations of mindfulness, that one abides independent, not clinging to anything in the world, which is so, so beautiful. Now, Anilayo, the German monk, he says that the 16 steps of Anapanasati are incredibly profound, quote unquote, and quote, more sophisticated than the Satipatthana Sutta. So I'm not, anyway, take that as you will, but it does catch our attention. And the 16 steps, they have two ways of looking at them to catch your attention. One is, in one way, they're linear. They take us from wherever we are in our body to a subtler and subtler and subtler seeing. So there's a real sense of linearity. And this is kind of energizing and clarifying. It has a sense of direction in our practice, with the caveat that we can get off this 16 wherever we want, wherever it's fruitful. And the other virtue, and kind of touches on what Dan was saying, that it integrates concentration and mindfulness in a way that isn't actually seen elsewhere in the suttas, at least as far as I know, by maintaining, saying out loud, repeatedly saying, maintaining mindfulness of breathing during all 16 of the steps. Hang on a second. So, trying to admit this person, there you go. So the concentration aspect can be important for practitioners in the West, because the way mindfulness is taught, it doesn't exactly, it sort of sidesteps the question of concentration or treats it as something that will arise, partly because that's a skillful way to approach the practice for people in incredibly busy lives. But in Asia, it's in the monastic setting, concentration is emphasized more than it is in the West, and sometimes emphasized first. So I think this mindfulness of breathing, 16 steps, is a way to integrate those two in a really useful way. So to turn toward the fourth tetrad, I'm going to take a quick look at how it differs from the first three, because the first three tetrads are related to our human experience. And in a way, they're kind of a setup for the fourth, which vaults us into this whole question about the nature of reality. So the first three, about body, about vedness, about mind, are really about our human experience. And then there's a big shift with the fourth one. But having said that, it's also the nature of the 16 steps that we can awaken, you know, anywhere along. So we should practice with a sense that each one of them is perfect and each one of them can be a doorway. So both things are true. Analaya says, I had the great privilege of having teachings from, not personally, of course, but in a series years ago. So that's where I got these quotes from, I think. He says, it's good to go through the whole thing. How much for each step is up to us, either quickly or over a long time. After that, we can work on any tetrad that may be helpful. So in that way, it's kind of a toolbox, you know, wherever is helpful. So in brief, the first three follow the pattern of body, vedana, and mind, like the Satipatthana, except that, and this is interesting, the Anapanasati is consistently more positive than the Satipatthana, and it's focused on breath. So the first tetrad, mindfulness of breathing, long, then short, then mindfulness of breathing with the whole body, then calming the body and breathing. The Satipatthana focuses on six different aspects of body. Breathing is only one of them. So this is very strongly focused on breathing in the first tetrad. The second tetrad focuses on the vedanas, feeling tones. But here, it's primarily pleasant, which is really, when you think about it, it's really interesting, because the Satipatthana is pleasant, unpleasant, and neutral. So out of those three, neutral and unpleasant can be more difficult. But Anapanasati is on the pleasant. The first two steps are pitti, and then joy, of pitti, which is joy, and sukha, which is happiness, then activities of the mind and calming of the mind. So it's a much more kind of a lifting way of looking at the vedanas. Because the Satipatthana is, in fact, as we explore it, we're often putting a lot of attention into the unpleasant, being mindful of that which is unpleasant, and it's a powerful tool to not be taken away by it. But when you sort of compare those two, it's pretty interesting how this is a lifting and a much more positive way. And the third tetrad, mind, starts with experiencing the mind, then moves to gladdening the mind, which is LP, then deepening, then liberating. Whereas the Satipatthana, in the mind section, it starts with the mind states of grasping and aversion, which arguably, you know, the three poisons, basically. So in this way also, this is like lifting us toward. It's really beautiful to think of the Anapanasati in that way. Analayo says, excuse me, the Satipatthana starts with the three poisons, which Anapanasati doesn't care about. It does care about concentrating and liberating the mind. So this kind of sets us up for the fourth tetrad. And as we were just talking about, the very last step of the third is liberating the mind, which in this context is one way of looking at it, is freeing the mind from any association of personhood, of selfing. It's just letting the mind be free as mind without it being me, just free as mind. Phil Fronsdell says, He's a wonderful Western teacher who's very skilled. Gil Fronsdell says, we self-liberate, letting go. Just whatever arises, let it go. We let go of everything. We let go of having an agenda, being the agent, whatever appears, letting go. In some ways, In some way, this is the beginning of the story. The Buddhist path begins when we have an experience of letting go. So it's a real profound direction. And, you know, Joyce really brought up, how is this? I think that's really helpful the way Gil looks at it. So this letting go, then, it moves us out of self-focus, which the first three argue are kind of focused on us, into the nature of reality. How our phenomena moves us in that direction. And the first characteristic of which is impermanence. The fourth tetrad says, and I'll read through the all four of the fourth tetrad. One trains contemplating impermanence, I shall breathe in. One trains contemplating impermanence, I shall breathe out. One trains contemplating dispassion, I shall breathe in. One trains contemplating dispassion, I shall breathe out. One trains contemplating cessation, I shall breathe in. One trains contemplating cessation, I shall breathe out. One trains contemplating letting go, I shall breathe in. One trains contemplating letting go, I shall breathe out. And kind of an aside, if you ever have a chance to read the numerical discourses in particular, numerical discourses is really interesting for those of you who probably know that I think it's unique in spiritual literature because it's organized in terms of how many items are named in a sutta. So there's the books of ones, the book of twos, the book of fives. So in the book of fives, all the suttas have five things in them. Whatever they're about, there's five things. It's really wild. And there are so many beautiful and kind of unique descriptions of the path to awakening buried. There's all kinds of gems. I was just talking to monks about it today, buried in the numerical discourses. But this particular pattern of dispassion, then cessation, then letting go, you'll see it's a deeper kind of letting go, appears repeatedly in various forms, in various substructures. So it's not just about the Anapanasati. It's something that the Buddha talks about over and over again in many different ways. So this is a kind of, insofar as this fourth tetrad parallels the fourth foundation of mindfulness, this is really different. Because the fourth foundation of mindfulness, dhammas or mind objects, is five lists in the Satipatthana Sutta. This is a whole different ballgame. It's focused on, I mean, I'm not saying it's not parallel, but it's focused on how we see the nature of phenomena and how we awaken. They're complementary. So the first of this last tetrad number, therefore 13 of the 16, we contemplate impermanence. So this means we open in our practice to the relentless, endless change of everything. And, you know, as Dan was saying, sometimes that's disturbing, like, come on, calm down. But actually, that's seeing. There's an aspect of it. Anyway, that's not the whole story, but I hear you. But it's also an aspect of it, is just seeing the relentless change of everything, no longer bound by selfing, by me and mine, seeking stability, because that's what we do. We try to get things to lock down and tie down and be nice for us. But when we're really open to impermanence and just watch that change, that's actually kind of unnerving, because we define our lives so much by things not moving, or at least not moving outside of our comfort zones. To actually see the total impermanence of everything is profound. And the essence of this means that we must be in this moment, because it's in this moment that this incessant change happens. So that's part of the balance of, you know, the mindfulness of breathing right here, right here, right here, and we're seeing this change constantly happening. Gil says, as we open to the present moment, what we experience is a constantly shifting flow of phenomena. The more still the mind is, the more it observes impermanence. The more unstable the mind, the more we impute permanence. Isn't that interesting? The more unstable the mind, the more we impute permanence. We try to make, or we layer a sense of staticness on things. Just because our minds are so unstable, we're not actually seeing what's actually happening, which is that it is, in fact, impermanent. And by the way, as an aside, Gil has some great, how do I say, unique and very creative translation things he does. And one of them is he uses the words inconstancy instead of impermanence. And it's pretty interesting. It's actually a better, arguably, a better translation for the Pali word anicca, because there's the Pali word nicca, N-I-C-C-A, and so this is anicca, the opposite of it, and nicca means constant, so it's not constant, is a way to look how this word could be translated. So more than any of the other tetrads, perhaps, the steps of the fourth, they follow quickly and seamlessly from each other. At least it's more obvious. Because the first three is like we're taking steps. These, they just roll in a very immediate way. So in the first step, 13, we contemplate impermanence. The underlying ephemeral nature of everything becomes clearer. You know, we see everything arising from something else and fading away. It's arising, passing. So the only constant is change. The only constant is change. Gill said, wisdom is the insight into the appearing and disappearing that is noble and penetrating and leads to the end of suffering. It is to be really at rest and centered and aware of the flow of experience and awareness. When the mind is still, we see how things move in and out of awareness. Normally, we sow these into continuousness. Sort of another version of what I read before, just to bring it home. So we're still contemplating mindfulness of breathing, contemplating impermanence, I shall breathe in, and then contemplating impermanence, I shall breathe out. So there's that steady metronome in the background. And so while we're aware of the impermanence of breathing, each breath arising from nowhere and vanishing into nothing, we're also opening to the impermanence or the inconstancy of all phenomena. And as our mindfulness of this goes deeper, it undermines core assumptions about what might be worth clinging to or who might be doing the clinging. It kind of peels this stuff apart, impermanence does. So because of that, we get to step 14 because it is deepening of seeing impermanence, which is contemplating dispassion. It naturally arises. Joseph Goldstein often uses the word disenchantment. And in some ways, I like that better because this passion sort of feels like, you know, we're not passionate about life or something. Disenchantment means we kind of broke the bubble of being enchanted by whatever because it's impermanent. So what's there to hang on to? What's there to be enchanted by? Another translation is fading away, and this Pali word viraga is built of raga, which can mean a die, which is therefore a sort of passion and lust. And V, it can mean fading. So there's a sense of fading away of clinging as another way of understanding dispassion. And as we deepen in dispassion, we see how grasping doesn't serve us. And we can ease up and be present and less entangled. So it's just kind of pulling away entanglement, this dispassion or disenchantment. The Buddha said, all created experiences are inconstant. And seeing this with insight, one becomes disenchanted with suffering. This is the path of purity. All created things are suffering. Seeing this with insight, one is disenchanted with suffering. All things are not self. Seeing this clearly, one is disenchanted with suffering. So there's a real sense of falling away of that which is sticking us. It's not like we're making something happen. It's just falling away. We're disenchanted. No, we see through it. And from dispassion then, or disenchantment, arises step 15, which refers to the absence of blockage or obstruction, which is a result of dispassion. It's a deeper lack of clinging. Gil Fronsdal calls it a sacred absence. He says, when this sense of absence of obstruction is strong enough, a person won't be the same again. One has then entered into the good current of full freedom. This carries us into the ocean of liberation and freedom. So cessation, it means something stops. You know, we've moved into disenchantment and then we just stop. Stop grasping. And then the very last, very interesting different translations. Relinquishment is one. Throwing back is another translation that's really interesting. But it just means no longer grasping. We're just throwing it back. It's like a deep letting go or relinquishment, letting go. It's a profound complete different stance of our relationship to inner and outer phenomena. And it's the last step toward awakening from this point of view. And we can see this arises naturally as these last aspects of grasping vanish with cessation. So in this last stage of 16th of the 16 steps, there's a deep relinquishment, just ready to put everything down. Just completely put everything down. You think about the Buddha, he put everything down. There was nothing he was grasping to, which is why he could hear people so well and be so present, because there was no I there to have it be about me, or, you know what I mean, have it be about him. The Pali term, and I'm in no way a Pali scholar, but it's patina saga, conveys an inclination of the mind toward awakening. So in this last step, this is turning toward nibbana. And of course, we work with it in the practice, but it's a doorway right there. It's a doorway right there. How cool is that? Thank you.
Thank you, Steve. Whew, this is a big series that we took on here. And when Steve and I were planning who was going to do what, he was giving the talk and then I was doing the guided meditation, which I'm going to do in a minute. And as I worked on that, I really didn't get any further than impermanence, which is, I think, a reflection of where I am in my practice. There are elements you'll hear in the guided meditation where the realization of things arising and passing away out of our control naturally leads to a clearer seeing of the clinging to things that aren't going to bring us the happiness we're seeking. So it's kind of my disclaimer before we start the guided meditation. And as I was reflecting on it, and I'm not a big chanter, but I do like certain chants. And many years ago, a visiting teacher who used to come quite a bit, Heather Martin, who lives on Salt Spring Island, taught me and a bunch of other people the impermanence chant. So we are going to chant that. You are all quiet, so you can chant it to your heart's content. I'm going to put it on the screen. Wait a second. This needs to be way bigger. Where is it? Hello. Okay, what's happening? Why is that not? Oh, I can do it that way.
Huh. Maybe it needs to be smaller because I'm seeing a title across the top, but everything's really giant.
Oh, you are. Huh. That's interesting. I have no idea what is going on with this screen share. Others might know this as well. it goes like this. Anicca vata sankara upadava ya domino upakitva neruchanti te sang vipassamo sukho. It's translated that all conditioned things arise and pass away. Understanding this deeply brings the greatest happiness, which is peace. So let's see, if I stop sharing and try it again, then maybe you could actually see Is it still the same kind of, you can't see the words? Well, bummer. I wanted folks, so once again, I'm defeated by technology.
Suze, could you sing a line and we could repeat it?
Yes.
Line?
Yes. So the first one is Anicca Vata Sankara. Anicca Vata Sankara. Upadava Yadomino. Upadava Yadomino. Upakitva Neruchanti. Upakitva Neruchanti. Te sang vipassamo. Sukho, te sang vipassimo sukho. While it is translated as all conditioned things arise and pass away, understanding this deeply brings the greatest happiness, which is peace. There's also an English chant that many of you might know, which is, all things are impermanent. They arise and they pass away. To be at peace with this truth brings great happiness. All things are impermanent. They arise and they pass away. To be at peace with this truth brings great happiness. I wanted to start with this chant, the bare truth of it, of all things are impermanent, they arise and they pass away. We all know the truth of impermanence, but it's really sometimes hard to fully and deeply experience impermanence beyond the cognitive understanding. We don't, you know, usually argue with it, but I think it's, at least for me, it can be challenging to experience it more bodily and fully. And I think that the breath meditation techniques can really help us move from just a mental understanding into a much more full body, mind, heart, vibrant understanding of the truth of impermanence. So as we settle down, if you need to shift your posture, find your feet on the floor, or if you've shifted to a cushion, establishing your posture, upright and relaxed. And as best as you are able, being present for the lived experience as it arises moment by moment. Really setting that intention to enter each moment. Being confident of being able to be here and now. Taking a moment to acknowledge what the body feels like right now, the sensations of the body. And whatever they are, it's okay. Inhaling, we're aware that we are sitting here in these bodies. Exhaling, we see if we can relax in the body. Soften any places of tension. When we first got together this evening, I asked you to just make a note of what your body felt like. whether there was any tension or tightness, contraction, or perhaps it was totally relaxed. Breathing in, noticing, has there been any change in just this hour since we first got together? Breathing in, really feeling what the state of the body is like. The shoulders, are they relaxed, and are they tight and high up by your ears? What about the area between the eyebrows or the set of your jaw? Breathing in, you feel fully what the body is feeling like right now. If there are pleasant sensations, we breathe in and we notice these pleasant sensations in the body. How relaxed we are, how comfortable. And perhaps in that moment, we notice the desire to keep those pleasant sensations around. Breathing in and out, settling in our bodies. We also are breathing in and out and noticing the state of our minds. Here we are in this meditation and study evening together. We notice if there are any pleasant thoughts and moods in the mind. Hopefully we're liking what we're exploring. We're interested in the possibility of learning more, honing our skills with the Anapanasati Sutta. Breathing in and breathing out, noticing whatever the state of mind, the flavor of the mind is. If it's settled, not filled with chatter, feel steady. We also notice the desire to keep those same thoughts around. Breathing in, we contemplate what happens when those desires to keep things, keep pleasant things around. We're training ourselves, breathing in and breathing out, noticing clearly the states of our bodies, noticing clearly the state of the mind. Breathing in and breathing out, we may notice that the length of the breath has changed. Our natural pace of the breath is usually pretty long. But as we're paying attention, we notice, oh, that's changed and it's shorter. Or perhaps our breathing natural pace is short and we're noticing that it has gotten longer. The breath has changed just in the times that we've been together. Breathing in and out, we may notice the differences between the inhale and the exhale. Breathing in, we notice what the sensations of the body that are really prominent when we inhale. Breathing out, perhaps we notice different sensations in the body that are prominent during the exhale. all of these changes, the short and the long, the changes in sensations in the body, changes in the flavor of the mind, all of this happens over and over again without our making anything happen. We contemplate inconstancy and permanence as we breathe in, and we contemplate inconstancy and permanence as we breathe out. We sense the beginning of the breath and the end of the inhale, sensitive to impermanence. We sense the ending of the out breath. As we took time to notice the changes in the body, the sensations that have come and gone, the tightness that might have been there and that is no longer, or the ease that was there at the beginning and instead there's now a contraction. We do the same kind of thing to notice the moods and emotions or trains of thought of the mind. Not pushing anything away, we pay attention to what has arisen. Breathing in, we contemplate whatever mood or thoughts are present in the mind. Breathing out, we contemplate those moods and thoughts. Breathing in and breathing out, we ask, is that mood constant? Is it the same that was there when we first started? Is there a change? Is there kind of an impatience or perhaps a greater relaxation? As we continue to notice and pay attention to the state of our minds, the flavor of the mind, perhaps gladness or joy are present. We sense how good that feels, a gladdening of the mind, a feeling of joy. We notice how desire arises to hold on to these pleasant states. And almost without too much effort, breathing in and breathing out, we notice that our natural discernment, our wisdom, recognizes this desire to hold on to the gladness and the joy. Breathing in, we feel what that desire to hold on to pleasant is like in the body and the mind. What that feeling of desire, that grip, that wanting to keep things just as we want them to be. We experience what that feels like in the body and the mind. Breathing in and breathing out, we become very familiar with the desire to hold on. Similarly, breathing in and breathing out, we become very familiar with the desire to push away. Well, the mind is scattered. It's jumping from this and that. I really don't like this. We feel that sensation, that desire to push away. We continue contemplating the mind, breathing in and breathing out. Sensitive to the impermanence of thoughts, to the impermanence of moods and emotions, we breathe in. sensitive to the impermanence of thoughts and moods and emotions we breathe out. Breathing in and breathing out, we contemplate how complex these minds can be. Restless 1 minute, steady and calm the next. Seeing things arise and pass away. Feeling these things arising and passing away. Contemplating the inclination to try to hold on and to seek happiness from all these fleeting experiences. We feel what holding on is like in the body and mind. We have felt the clinging, breathing in and breathing out through this clinging, through this holding on. The practice shows up, all those teachings that are floating around in our minds, all the voices of the teachers. And we notice that we know the limitations of this clinging. We have a deep knowing of inconstancy and impermanence. All things arise and pass away. As we contemplate clinging and non-clinging, we have a glimpse into the cessation of greed and aversion. We sense in the body the full experience of grasping and non-grasping. Breathing in, we notice the way non-grasping feels in the body. Breathing out, we notice the way non-grasping feels in the body. Breathing in, we notice how non-grasping feels in the mind. Breathing out, we notice how non-grasping feels in the mind. Breathing in and breathing out, we watch as we let go of the grasping. We watch as we let go of pushing things away that we don't like. Breathing in, letting things be as they are. Breathing out, letting things be as they are. Breathing in, feeling a sense of lightness, of ease that comes from that non-clinging, letting things be just as they are. Perhaps it's just a millisecond of experience, a moment when the tight fist of clinging is released and the light starts shining through the fingers that before were all clenched. Continuing to contemplate impermanence, knowing that we know the difference between holding on and non-clinging. Breathing in and breathing out, we sense what letting go can feel like in the body and mind. Breathing in, one can feel the peace of that letting go. Breathing out, one feels the peace of it. breathing in, we sit with the way things are in this moment. Breathing out, we sit with the way things are in this moment. Breathing in, ease. No resistance, no clinging. Calm, steady, light, no clinging. Breathing out, we feel that ease just in this moment. This moment is just what it is, and it's okay. Breathing in and breathing out, knowing the truth of all things arise and pass away. We feel that ease, that calm, steady, light, easeful. This moment is like this, and it's okay. And now we have time, quite a bit of time actually, to just talk about how you are with this fourth tetrad of impermanence and cessation. And relinquishment. For me, the really being in touch with when I cling, when I'm holding on really tight, fully experiencing that has been such a teacher for me. Because to a great extent, I never really noticed when I let go. I think holding on was such a normal way of being that I'm not sure I always was aware of when I wasn't doing that. So feel free to unmute and share questions, comments, reflections, anything.
And certainly Linda and Lauren, please chime in. Yeah, any thoughts you have, or you know, any answers or whatever to anything. Yeah.
Yeah, Deanna, please go ahead.
Something that I've been wondering kind of all along, was, and Steve kind of mentioned it tonight, but following in order all 16 steps and then maybe working on a certain tetra section. So I guess, what do you suggest practicing this?
Who wants to respond to that?
I'm having some trouble like remembering all the pieces. Yeah. And so I was, you know, even taking a bit at a time each week, I don't know, I'm just struggling a little bit.
Lauren has a response.
Yeah, I think it's cumulative, and I really like starting with the body and the breath and seeing the there's impermanence in that. I mean, there's impermanence, there's feeling tone, definitely. And it brings calm, you know, it supports the mind being concentrated and calm and stable. So I really want to spend a lot of time with the breath. And I think from what I've read and from the teachers, that's just fine. You know, just be where you are. And then, you know, things come up in your life, because also you can take it to your daily life, like the breath, just being aware of breathing and seeing, you know, what is it? You know, it helps with agitation and living with dukkha that you have in your life. So that's my feeling, is that you can take, I think Steve said that too, like any part is a gateway. And but I think starting with the breath and the body is really, you can stay there a long time. There's a lot of ways to approach experience with breathing. So that's what I have to say.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah, I think that holographic sort of nature of it, I mean, sort of wherever, well, you can do it sequentially, certainly, and it may be that certain parts of it resonate. To me, it's kind of like a, like, I don't know, some magic 16 doorways and different parts suddenly open, or I'll think of something, or I'll, you know, the fourth tetra is really amazing. Like I said, it's paralleled elsewhere in the suttas. Or maybe, you know, if you're in practice and you feel pity or sukha, you know, and sort of bring that into the whole thing. So I think just wherever it touches for you, but I wouldn't worry about it or make it a project, you know, rather make it a kind of like a happy exploration.
Yeah, for me, when I start a sit, I often ask what's the body and mind needing, wanting to do today? And sometimes it's very grounded in the body, and other times it's really wanting to explore what are the different attitudes and happenings in the mind. So I just kind of wait and hear what is being asked for. I liked what Steve said of not making it into a project. I could see, you know, like having little cards made up with all the 16 and then having them around and looking at them and stuff. It makes me a little tired thinking about doing that. but, you know, it's also, we're different. We have different preferences and inclinations. And for some, that would be a really good thing to have it printed up and like on the wall near where you sit, so that you wouldn't have to have it memorized. It doesn't have to be a big job, but it's really available. Yeah, Joyce, please.
I was wondering, it seems to me, and I was wondering if you feel if this last tetrad is a little different than the first three, if it has a different focus in that the translations we have here say contemplate for all four steps. Another one says focus on. And so it's more of a mental reflection as opposed to the other ones. I was trying to make the other ones more into a meditation where I eventually wasn't, you know, like I was eliminating the mental processes and all that. So I eventually was coming to a quiet. And now in this fourth one, it's more like awaken your mind a little bit, or am I misinterpreting that?
Because those concepts, I can understand it. Go ahead, Steve.
Oh, I was just saying, it seems like it's the fourth one. Seems like it's describing how our understanding shifts and sort of naming it. So I think you're right. I mean, it is, to me, it is categorically different, but it's emerging inherently, it seems to me. I'm interested to hear what Lindell has to say.
It seems like, I mean, there's a way in which you can do it as a contemplation. I think like going through each of those different categories and noticing their impermanence, as Suze was doing in our meditation, which I really like. But I think there's also a way in which when you've done all of the earlier three tetrads and the mind is really in a very calm and concentrated state, it will just see that impermanence in a very clear way. It'll just see it and understand it. And that seeing is not anything you can make happen. It just happens when it happens. So there's that aspect of it too. It's sort of like, in that part, it's like insight happens, but it happens when it happens. So there's the contemplating, and then there's the mind being in the place where it can see really clearly, so insight happens. And I think there's both going on. And I don't totally understand for sure, but that's my sense.
Yeah, that's nice, because the first one's body, the second and third are sort of qualities of mind that is in our practice, and then this breakthrough happens. You know, it takes us into a shift.
Steve, were you done with that? I was going to have Lori, please go ahead.
First, just thank you, all of you. And some curiosities arose as I was, you know, hearing your teachings on this. And I remember attending your day long on the Satipatthana, and the mirroring, not just in the bhikkhus who the Buddha gave this to were already practicing Satipatthana, but that in offering the Anapanasati, it's like I kind of have this feeling physically of almost it allows the Satipatthana to pop, you know, these innate core, which two things leads me to want to ask you all to please strongly consider offering Satipatthana in a 5-week series, because, you know, I've done the intro course a number of times, and every time something, just there's a richness and a beauty, and you know, most recently the just how there already is, you know, in the first two classes, this directing and letting go, you know, recognizing and allowing this relational, impermanent relational quality in the Satipatthana intro course. And rain does not get offered until the class three, because there is this identical setup. And I think of just how important it is to have a really, really solid Dhamma foundation. Otherwise, there is this grasping and this and that veer off, and concentration no longer is, you know, in this holiness of waking up and the precepts. It becomes another task to do, you know, to accomplish, to almost get rid of this deeper angst that without a firm satipatthana, and then also hearing, Steve, when you mentioned, like, you know, at the very end, the Patini saga, the throwing back, and I thought of Buddha, you know, Ajahn Buddhadasa, you know, servant of the Buddha, you know, but it's this almost this completion and this. So I'm very curious on this completion. Are there sutta teachings about what does this completion look like? Does that mean then that deeper stuff in one's unconscious, you know, deeper sankharas, kleshas, anusaya, then get released to come up in this stable base that we've created? Or do the suttas say, yep, then there's this supreme, like, letting go and you're gone and you're fine? Or is it really this preparation for this deeper ground of stability of practice, so whatever is in that substrate, it's met with this deeper capacity of wholesomeness? So that's my request. Thank you for considering these profound teachings and your all's practice. It's like, wow, vows, deep vows.
Well, that's, you're totally deep too, Lori, and you've been around the Dharma for a long, long time. You know, it seems like in the suttas, and please, my other colleagues, say, you know, correct me or whatever, but it seems like it's always pointing towards falling away. You know, falling away of our concretization, or falling away of our sense of self. And it doesn't really point to what that's like. It just talks about the falling away, then we see what it's like. And it's tricky because, you know, for those of us who have been in Tibetan tradition, sometimes there's a little more of an articulation of, you know, nature of mind or rupa or something like that. But then it's tricky because we can concretize that and make it a thing that we're trying to grasp at. So it's part of why I loved the Nikayas of Theravada tradition. It's just falling away, and then we see. But from the falling away, it's just a sense that it's natural. That's what I love about the 16 steps, is it's natural. You can just see how all the stickiness just collapses. So that resonates, perhaps, I don't know.
I've often heard, you know, too, the sense that there are kind of stages where different attachments and different, what would you say, defilements and other things, gradually they fall away. You know, some fall away first, like, you know, first there might be this, the understanding of that the self is not permanent, but it might take quite a while before that sense of self, feeling of me actually, and the comparing that creates it actually falls away. So I think in what you're saying about it going, there being some understanding and then it going deeper and deeper and deeper as you practice and practice and understand more and more deeply is my understanding of it also. That's very vague, but
no, that's good. And isn't it interesting how it's like linear and holographic at the same time? I mean, we can have like suddenly something will shift, you know, waiting for the bus, and suddenly we just see at this ridiculous, unlikely time. And then other times there's also an accumulation over, you know, years of practice. That's also true. Kind of both things are true. So I think part of what I love about the 16 steps is it kind of like, it, you know, seeing can happen anytime. There is every moment's a sacred moment because we're fully right there.
So, Steve, we're kind of at that you're kind of closing time, unless something.
Shashi has a hand up.
Sorry, yeah. I didn't see your hand.
Okay, I just figured out how to unmute. Thank you. I wanted to second Laurie's request that we have a similar Satipatthana Sutta session, which I think would be very useful. And I think that it seems like there are different levels of understanding this. And my view is that it's kind of this whole exercise is a parallel to body scanning, as it were, where you spend time focusing on the body and the breathing, and then on the emotions, and then on the mind, and then onto the dharma, as it were, in total. And there's lots of references to training, which I like. You train the mind, you know, you train yourself to do this, and you train yourself. So from where I am, I find this very useful tool altogether. So thank you very much.
Dan. Having trouble unmuting.
You're still muted, everybody.
Yeah.
Oh, here I am. Just, you know, the beginner's thought is, it seems like this last tetrad to me lays out like a lot of what I've been trying to learn is, here are the truths to be discovered. And then here's the path to discovering them. So this last tetrad just made perfect sense to me. It's like, well, this is what you're going to get. You may not understand it now. You may not be able to hold it, but it's impermanent. And there's suffering along with it, and clinging will make it worse. And pay attention to the Eight Noble Truths, because that's the way out of this morass. So I don't know if that's the right way to look at it, but I feel like, okay, like you've told me what the truths are that one could realize. And then people like me are left to say, okay, now how do you get there? Or like, you know, maybe I'm obsessed with how do you stabilize it? How do you enact it on a daily basis? How do you know when you're getting closer to it or drifting away from it? And I don't know if that's the right way to look at it, but I feel like some of these teachings are just, here it is, man. This is where you're headed. If you want to go there, here's how you do it. But I don't know if that's silly or...
No, that makes sense. No, we're all agreeing.
It's right on.
It's break it. Adds content to the third noble truth, that there is cessation. And then, you know, a lot of you go, huh, well, that sounds good. How does that happen? And this teaching is one of the ways that it happens. And I think, as Steve said, the same, maybe not in the exact same order, but certainly the recognition of impermanence and not self, and how we see clearly our role in creating the obstacles to freedom. And we keep seeing clearly and more clearly and more clearly. And then I don't personally know how it happens. I'm one of those that believe in Joseph Goldstein's small moments many times. And that has been really helpful and inspirational for me. I'm, you know, I I don't see myself in the stories of the time with the Buddha where they heard the teachings and there was enlightenment. I don't know if it's just the stubbornness in me of holding on to old views and habits, but I have experienced those small moments of freedom, and they're pretty wonderful. So I think the way you're going with this, Dan, sounds great. And it sounds like it fits for you. I don't think there's a one size fits all to, like, how do we practice with these different teachings. And yeah,
I would kind of like there to be.
Well, if you find it, share it with us all.
No, I've been hoping you're going to tell me. And you are telling me little by little. And then I think the challenge is to try to enact it.
Yeah, I feel like, I mean, there's instructions and suggestions. It's sort of like you talking about, Dan. It says, well, this is where you're going. Here's some things to do to get there. But the path between doing the things and getting there is its own mystery for all of us, I would say.
And that there are surprises.
Yes, very much so.
I just came back from a month long. I was so surprised at what happened. And it was so hard the first 10, 12 days. And when I saw how I was creating my own dukkha and could start understanding it, things changed for me. But boy, and it was a surprise. I thought, really? That's what happened here? That's what happened. The mind, the circumstances, the conditions, there it was. And so there's both mystery and I think sometimes surprise when those moments of seeing clearly and then making an appropriate response to what we're seeing and experiencing.
It was all part of that. A quote that Lauren mentioned, the mind is luminous, obscured by visiting defilements. And it's kind of like the path of practice insofar as their journey to awakening is a falling away of defilements or falling away of obstructions that we keep encountering as we go along, as we're cultivating awareness. And the thing that we become aware of is the defilement of the moment in our unpeeling, our de-onioning. So it's kind of like everybody's different. It's all kind of a mystery how it happens, but just bringing awareness to that which emerges is the deal.
Okay.
Right on. Go for it, Dan. Okay.
Well, I'm supposed to do
our closing.
Close and dedication of merit. Are there any announcements, by the way? Is anything
other than the Donna announcement?
Yeah, and I will say that, by the way, in terms of Clear Mountain, there's a Katina ceremony on the 20th, which means annual robe offering. And because of Clear Mountain is getting land and all this stuff, there's a bunch of monks coming from around the world. It's a big deal on the 20th. So if you're interested at Blood Hall, where Rodney used to teach, and also Ponte Rahula, I did make an announcement, is going to be
for next Thursday.
Correct.
At the Seattle Insight Center, and it's both online and in person. Bhante Rahula will be speaking, and it's a joint event co-sponsored by both Seattle Insight and Clear Mountain. And some of us have had the privilege of hearing Bhante Rahula when he was at Clear Mountain some weeks back, and he is delightful.
Yeah.
And he has so much joy. He could barely contain it. It was like he was floating off of his cushion. That was my experience of him.
He's
He's
so that's next Thursday.
Right? Yeah, and also a day long on the following Sunday. He's just ridiculously radiant. I say that in a complete loving, approving way. Not that he's ridiculous, but it's just,
it's quite just the level of exuberance and joy.
It's just a delight.
Yeah.
Okay. Okay. And I just want to honor, I'm always struck in these kind of gatherings, how the wisdom that everybody brings, and we're all kind of swimming in formation here. You know, we have this teacher role, but everybody's seeing. So thank you very much for showing up with the depth that you all have. And dedication of merit, as you know, that means to sit upright for a minute and take in, appreciate, kind of embrace the merit, the beauty, the energy, the love that we've gathered here together. And think of beings you know who may be sick or have died, could be a four-legged or a fish or a human, and maybe I'll name Dr. Dan, who has a glioblastoma, my friend Jamyang Dorje, who has a cancer in his spine, I think. Two people. Anybody else?
I have some people that I'm not going to list their names because I haven't gotten permission to do that.
And I'd like to offer John Flynn. He made his transition Tuesday, the 9th.
John Flynn. And if anyone else you want to do it, you know, silently in your hearts, but just hold this energy that we have, this beautiful shimmering light of awakening, of love, and dedicated to these beings, that they can find some peace, some space, some open heart light in the midst of their pain or their transition or their disease moving onward. And then just expanding our hearts and minds over this globe, this earth, this tiny little blue sphere hurtling through space, and all the struggles and war zones and repressions and pain everywhere, and dedicated that these people could find a moment of peace, a moment of freedom, even in the middle of pain, a moment of looking ahead, a moment of caring for the other near them. I don't have a nearby bell, so I'll just say ding. There you go. For the team. And we're going to we're not meeting the next time, but we're meeting again on the 25th. And can someone who's more on it than me articulate what we're doing on the 25th?
We'll be wrapping up the series, and actually the four of us are meeting soon to decide exactly how we're going to do that. Probably be a guided meditation, a lot of discussion. We don't know yet, but it's kind of the wrap up of the series. And just, we wanted everyone to know that any Donna that you want to share, if you send it to my Venmo, you can find that on the webpage, I will then share it with everybody. We're sharing the Donna equally. Be well, everyone. Thank you so much for being part of this as we discover what there is to discover.